Well, good afternoon, everyone. How's everybody doing today?
Good.
You all are in for a real special treat. Chris Schroeder is here from Baskin Ridge, New Jersey. Close enough. Chris is one of my favorite all-time speakers. He has a message that's clear and has depth and has weight, and he's going to share with you all some knowledge of the steps and some humorous anecdotes mixed in here and there. So you all be on your best behavior and welcome Chris Schroeder.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic.
Yes. And,
it truly is special for me to get out here. I feel this place and this place is hallowed ground, and the mission that goes on here is beyond remarkable. I've been exposed to a lot of professionals and a lot of different treatment processes myself. I'm a board member in a number of different areas where people pay attention to and try to figure out how best to help alcoholics and addicts, people with addictive illnesses like us. And I can tell you that what goes on here is absolutely remarkable compared to many, many other places. You know, addictive illness, alcoholism or drug addiction, very unorthodox illness. When you think about an illness, okay, I'm ill, you know, there's things going wrong with me, I need help. You think about going to a doctor, or you think about, you know, getting medicine, or you think about getting an operation. You know, basically what happens in those instances is the doctors or the medicine kind of change your inner environment to the point where healing can happen. And you don't really have to play a major role in that, except participating in, you know, going to the doctor and taking the medicine or doing the operation. In addictive illness, there is many, many aspects to it that are unorthodox. What happens is that when you are suffering from addictive illness, it's going to take a commitment from you to participate in the process. And this is where we lose a lot of people. I want to talk about step one, and then I'll get back into the necessary participation, personal commitment that we have to be able to survive this thing. But I think it's important to understand step one. Many of us believe step one about this much, and we really need to fully understand what the ramifications of step one. I'll talk a little bit about my own personal experience and how it started to dawn on me that I was in way more trouble than I thought I was. I started drinking when I was 12 or 13. Immediately, I enjoyed it a lot more than the other kids I was drinking with. It seemed to do something for me that it didn't do for them. I had a difficulty like integrating. I had anxiety, social fear. I don't even know what it was, but by drinking alcohol, almost immediately, it made me feel larger than life. It did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I started to drink it, and I made it a part of my life, either consciously or unconsciously. It became a part of my life from a very, very young age, and I would plan on where I was going to drink. I would plan on who I was going to be drinking with, how I was going to get it. You know, all of these thoughts became very, very important to me. And, you know, looking back on it, they were probably the most important thing in my life, although I didn't know it at the time. So I started drinking. Now, alcoholism is progressive. From the beginning, I had a craving. the craving is basically one drink always does one thing. It asks for the second drink. The second drink insists on the third. The third demands the fourth. That happened to me from a very young age. That's not every alcoholic is going to have that experience. But from the beginning, I would drink basically until I passed out. And, so I would try to, limit my amount. I'd try to use other substances to counteract that because I knew it was not cool to like pass out at the party. So I would do different things to try to keep that from happening. Drink beer instead of the hard liquor, which I like. But from the beginning, it started to progress for me. And I started to pay a lot of price. I started to get in a lot of trouble and, things happen when you drink a lot of bad things can happen and they started to happen to me. I crashed a lot of cars. Any car crashers in here? Any DUI people? Yeah! Let the record show 70% of the people raise their hand. I always felt like I should feel confident when driving. So alcohol always made me confident. So you would catch me most of the time drinking with a beer between my legs. It was, I guess, a different time back in the 70s than it is now. But I did. I crashed a lot of cars. I did very poorly in school, and this was unusual for my family. I come from a really, really smart family. My brother and sister are both college professor PhDs, and then I came along. So I come from a really, really smart family, and I started to do badly in school, somewhere around junior high. I started to just not care. I had more important things to do. My major became exit. That's what my major became. All I wanted to do was get out of there. And I had some stuff I wanted to do, and it had absolutely nothing to do with sitting around talking about U.S. history or, whatever they were trying to teach me. So I started to do bad, and they started to put me in work-study classes. That's where you go to school 4 periods and then go to work 4 periods, and I did that. But, looking back on it, alcoholism just warped so much of my life that it's hard for me to even I couldn't imagine it at the time. I really thought that this is what I wanted. This is the way I think. This is how I live. This is me. And really, what was happening was I was being molded in a very destructive way by alcoholism. Now, fast forward about 18 years, and alcohol's starting to get my attention in a big way. I'm starting to do things that are really scaring me. First of all, it's making me incredibly ill. I'm almost at a point where I'm not going to be able to work anymore because I'm so sick. I was about 135 pounds in the late 80s, and I would drink about a quart of whiskey a night, and many, many times a handful of Xanax or Valium or whatever. And if you do that, that's going to deteriorate your body. I wasn't going to exercise class and eating a macrobiotic diet either. I wouldn't eat, and then I'd get hungry when I was drunk, and I'd make a bacon sandwich, on white bread. I wasn't taking care of myself so much. So physically, I was deteriorating. But what really scared me even more was, when I would get drunk, I would start to get more and more violent, and I would take something that you said, and I'd turn it into like fighting words, and I really started to develop a type of a psychotic and violent behavior when I was drinking. And this really wasn't me. I mean, I didn't want to be that way. So I want to talk definitely about step one. Here's where I started to learn a little bit about step one. It had caught my attention to the degree that I decided to sign myself into a 28-day treatment center. This is about the beginning of 1989. Now, if you knew me, you would know what kind of a commitment that would be for me. I was not being forced into this. I said, I need help. I need to go to a treatment center. And I learned about the treatment center because I had to go to outpatient to get my license back for, you know, one of the multiple DUIs. So I decide to sign myself into a treatment center. Now, this is a commitment from me. I mean, I wouldn't have been doing this if I didn't really want to stop drinking. I knew that alcohol was killing me. I knew that it was causing problems in my life, and I knew it had to stop or it was going to end up stopping me. So I signed myself in. Now, if you would have known my personality at that time, I didn't like crowds. I didn't like authority. I didn't like being, you know, definitely didn't like being told what to do or being in a certain place and having to be there and not be able to leave. I had real difficulty with personal relationships. Most people would really annoy me. And so putting myself in a 28-day treatment center had to be a big deal for me because I was going someplace that I knew I was not going to enjoy. So I went to this treatment center, and I really felt I was probably one of the only people in there who really wanted to stop drinking. That's why I was there. There were many people in there that were there for interventions or DUIs or this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, I really, really wanted to be there to stop drinking. I wanted to, whatever they offered, whatever secrets they told, whatever methodology they had for separating from alcohol, I wanted that. And I wanted it a lot. So I went through the 28-day treatment, and then they told me, okay, we want you to go to outpatient. You know, you've done your primary. Now we want you to do your aftercare. And we want you to go to some AA meetings. And so I started doing that. I was going to two AA meetings a week, two outpatient a week. And I truly was under the impression that this is what I was being told to do. This, I'm willing to do it. I should be okay. And one day, driving to an AA meeting, the thought crossed my mind that it would be a good idea to buy a gallon of vodka and drink it. And the reasoning I came up with was, you know, I don't feel like I've got like a full commitment to this thing. You know, I really want to not drink the rest of my life. I really want to do well with this AA. It doesn't feel like I'm fitting in. I'll bet you if I drink a gallon of vodka, I'll be able to go back and I'll really be able to do this recovery stuff well. Because it'll remind me how bad it is to drink and, you know, I'll just come rushing back. So I convinced myself to drink a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. Now, that does not make a lot of sense to most people. But, you know, in our book, it talks about the strange mental blank spots that precede the first drink, the subtle forms of insanity that precedes our going back out. And this was a beautiful manifestation of that. You know so much in hindsight. So, you know, I'm looking back now in time, and I'm seeing all this very, very clearly. I had the physical craving. The physical craving was once I started drinking, I had little or no control over the amount I took. I would normally end up drinking myself into unconsciousness. The second part is okay, I've recognized that alcohol is a bad thing. I got it from here. You know, I'm going to give it up. And I also saw in that last relapse or that last time that I bought the vodka that I don't have the power to stay stopped. And that scared the hell out of me. That's one of the realizations that you come to if you're in a really good recovery program. You start to see what is your truth in the first step. Can you, by your own unaided will, decide, make a commitment to not drinking or not using, and have that mean anything? This is where we lose so many people in in the 12-step fellowships, it's where we lose so many people who leave primary treatment or whatever, recovery processes, and find that they can't maintain their own sobriety. And we end up dying. You know, the statistics are just really not good if you have alcoholism or if you have drug addiction. The statistics are really not good. It's a very, very aggressive illness. Addictive illness is very aggressive, and it really requires an aggressive recovery process. An aggressive recovery process that we don't think we really need. And that, again, is another piece to this that makes it very difficult to survive addictive illness. Now, there's been times where I used a lot of drugs also. Again, many times I used drugs so that I could continue to drink. Many times I used drugs just to get rid of the anxiety, to get rid of the, you know, they talk a lot about the spiritual malady, I'm sure here, and in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the spiritual malady, I see that as just basically, in a nutshell, being uncomfortable with yourself and being uncomfortable with your environment. And that was me. I was just so, so uncomfortable all the time. I always wanted to be somewhere else, doing something else with somebody else. Very, very rarely would I be okay with any specific thing. I was always just, you know, this just isn't it. I heard an alcoholic talk one time. He did a lot of work with the early rock bands. And he said he was sitting backstage with the Beatles one time, and he was just wishing he could be somewhere else. You know, that's typical. That's typical of the alcoholic. You know, nothing is good enough. I want to talk a little bit about the spiritual malady. I think everybody in here certainly understands the physical craving, the mental obsession. Whether you've fully bought into the mental obsession yet is kind of key. Because when you fully buy into the mental obsession, a lot of your resistance to the recovery processes and the following direction and everything like that drops away. You know, because you give up because, you know, why fight something that's gonna help you? But a lot of times we don't understand the spiritual malady at real key levels. I told you about how I felt, you know, as a young kid and when I started to drink. I had anxiety, self-centered fear. I was always worried about what people were going to think of me. You know, I was always worried about how am I showing up? You know, I definitely have to show up cool or else, you know, I'm going to be humiliated. I had a lot of those type of feelings, but the spiritual malady is really, really a deep problem. And I don't know if we'll ever know why addictive illness is so coupled with the spiritual malady. I know that it's prevalent in almost all of us to a great degree. I believe you can get addicted to certain drugs, but that doesn't necessarily make you a drug addict. I believe you can get addicted to alcohol, but that doesn't necessarily make you an alcoholic. But most of the people that I know who are alcoholics or drug addicts have major cases of the spiritual malady. I was being driven to kindergarten one time. All right, my mother came in and said, "Today's your first day of school. You know, get dressed. I'm driving you across town to kindergarten." And I remember jumping in the car. I didn't know much about what was going on. I was a kid that was kind of in his own head most of the time. But I did what she told me to do. We drove across town. She opened up the door. She said, "There's your classroom down there. I'll be back in 4 hours." And closed the door and drove away. And I remember this clear as day because I remember standing up on the hill looking down and seeing all the kids playing. And they're already friends and they're playing tag and kickball. And I'm standing up on the hill scared. I want to go home. You know, who came up with this kindergarten idea? This is not going to work. And, you know, I was terrified. I was worried about what the other kids were going to think of me. There was too many of them. And I was filled with that self-centered fear. Now, I've heard a lot of people with addictive illness talk about this same type of thing. I had to do the kindergarten thing, though. So I went down and I became, you know, a kindergartner. And it was never any fun for me. I don't remember my first 12 years going through school being that fun at all. Not while I was in school, at least. You know, I had some good times afterward. But I was uncomfortable with that particular environment. And I see that as like the first manifestation of the spiritual malady that I can personally remember. Because I'll tell you why it ties in with alcohol. Because if on that first day of being a kindergartner, they would have handed me a half a pint of vodka and I would have drank it, everything would have been fine that day. Because the alcohol would have smoothed everything out for me. But they weren't serving five-year-olds back then. If I remember right, I think the drinking age was like 21. So it was many years later when I discovered alcohol. But that self-centered fear, that feeling different than, that feeling separated from, is a key part of addictive illness. You know, if you're lucky and you stay sober long enough to recover, part of your recovery process is going to be digging into spiritual practices, because that becomes second nature to you. You're pretty much like you were driven into drugs and alcohol. You're driven into spiritual processes and spiritual practices, however they look to you. And one of the things that I've discovered over the years is many of the saints and sages, many of the enlightened spiritual masters and mystics have come to one conclusion. And that conclusion is that mankind's big problem is separation from God, feeling separate than, being apart from. And no one manifests that more than an alcoholic and an addict. No one is further away from that oneness that they all talk about in these spiritual disciplines than the alcoholic or the addict. We are on our own island. You know, so it doesn't surprise me that part of recovery and part of the growth that happens in recovery is seeking out a better connection with the divine. And you know, some of us go about it in different ways than others. But I think to be able to remain sober and have some kind of quality to your life, you have to kind of aim in that direction. So the treatment process for alcoholism is not necessarily a treatment process to separate you from alcohol or to separate you from drugs. That's part of it. But if that's all it was, and then we would be fine, then you'd just be breaking an addiction. We have much more than that. We have alcoholism, or we have drug addiction. Believe me, if you're in this place, you know, you're in the right place. So some of the other manifestations of unmanageability. There can be external unmanageability. A lot of times the external unmanageability is good because it'll get us into places. It'll get us to look at our behavior. Sometimes we'll be forced into looking at sobriety because of parole or, you know, whatever. But if you do a lot of drugs, the chances are you're going to get arrested. If you drink heavily, the chances are you're going to drive while you're drinking or cause some kind of problem while you're drinking. And get put in a position where you're gonna be forced to look at some stuff. So there's some external unmanageability, but that's not really the barometer that we judge alcoholism or drug addiction by. I'll give you a for instance. My first marriage is blowing up. I got married in 1979 the first time, and by 1981 I was working on a divorce. And I moved into a couple of my buddies. I moved into a house with a couple of my buddies. One of them was a Quaalude dealer, And the other was a guy who was like constantly on unemployment all the time. And these guys partied. The one guy really ended up being a drug addict because he died of cirrhosis of the liver about 15 years ago from just overuse of every kind of downer you could possibly get your hands on. The other guy drank with me, and we drank. We were absolutely insane. We would both buy a quart of hard liquor. He was a rum drinker. I was a bourbon drinker. And we would just sit down and we would drink to finish those bottles and to get in trouble. And some of the things that happened with him were absolutely crazy. This guy's behavior was just as bad as mine. You know, we'd be shooting off shotguns in apartment complexes. I can't even tell. I remember this one time. The neighbors called the police because we were having a loud party. And I got a listen, it's 1 o'clock in the morning on like a Tuesday, and we've got the stereo blasting, the windows open, you can hear us 6 blocks away. Of course somebody should call the police, you know? And the police came, and this is back when they would tell you who called. So as soon as the police left, I took my buddy's shotgun and I blew the satellite dish off the neighbor's house. And I started yelling at the house, "You're gonna call the cops now!" You know? I mean, and this is all in a blackout because I remember just going to work the next day, walking by the house like nothing's going. I mean, crazy stuff. I was drinking with this guy and he was right along with me, absolutely crazy. And here's what happened to him. He met a girl. You know, we were both single, crazed people that, you know, women would just he'd see us at the bar a mile away and say, "I'm staying away from him." But he hooked up with a girl and he started dating her, and she didn't really like him drinking a quart of whiskey with Chris, you know, on the weekend. So he started to cut back, and you know, I know him to this day. I'm still in touch with this guy. He moderated. He went down to, you know, just having a couple of drinks on the weekend, maybe not even doing it. He didn't need it, you know. He was doing it to have fun. He was doing it because there was nothing else to do, because it spiced up life a little bit. My relationship with alcohol was different. I was doing it to feel okay. You know, I did not feel okay sober. So looking at this unmanageability, there's external unmanageability. You can get in a lot of trouble, but that does not necessarily mean getting in trouble because of booze or alcohol does not necessarily mean that you're an alcoholic or you're an addict. I like to look at the barometer of power, choice, and control. That lets me in a very, very deep way into the mechanics of my addictive qualities. Do I have power over the alcohol when I start to drink it? No. Do I have choice over when I put it in my body? Obviously, no. What kind of power do I have in my life? Do I have the power in my life to recreate my life and start to feel good about myself? To start to put the pieces of my life together so that, you know, I start to build and develop something worth having, a life worth living. And I have obviously didn't have that either. Now, I think most people in here are acquainted at least a little bit with the bedevilments, you know, not being in control of your emotional nature. That was me. Not being able to make a living. Now, some of us can make a lot of money. Some of us do okay, even when we're drinking or drugging, with making money. But making a living is a little bit different. What does your life look like? Does your life really have the quality that you want? I did not have that. So that's a piece of my life that's unmanageable. Spiritually, I was bereft. I was separate from. I didn't connect with, and I always felt like there was something seriously wrong with me inside. And all of this is wrapped up in addiction. You know, step one, If we're lucky, we'll be able to take our personal truth with step one and use that as a foundation to start participating in a recovery process. If we don't, we're in a lot of trouble because, like I said earlier, addictive illness requires the participation of the person who has it to recover from it. You can't do it yourself, but if you're not participating in the recovery process, you're just not going to make it. Now, looking at step two, I remember my first exposure to step two. I looked up on the wall, and I knew these people weren't kidding me. They were talking about God. And many of us, when we first are exposed to recovery processes, we're going to have an issue with that because of our preconceived understanding of what God is, who God is, what God is in charge of, what God's job is. And I had kind of a bizarre conception of God. It maybe not really bizarre because, you know, I picked up on what God was from Sunday school, and I was a Methodist until I was about 12 years old, and when they gave me permission to go or not go, I stopped going. But, you know, I did go to church, I did go to Sunday school, and I was exposed to a lot of the things that happened there. Now, a lot of times it's the messenger, it's not the transmitter of the message that gets it wrong. You know, I had a broken receiver. I don't think the messenger was broken, I think the receiver was broken because of just the way I was and my alcoholic separation. I believe that that God was someone up there who was basically in charge of punishing me when I did things that were wrong, keeping track of all of my sins of omission and commission, and every once in a while might get involved in worldly affairs if it was serious enough. And I am not going to meet that God or be in that God's presence until I'm dead. And this is just the conception that I had as a child. So what, and it didn't really change from age 12 on because I wasn't interested. You know, it's not convenient to be thinking a lot about that type of a God when you're doing crimes, you know, or you're running around with illegal drugs and, you know, just pillaging and running wild. So it's not something that I was paying a whole lot of attention to. And then when I get into AA and I see it up on the wall, God is as I understand Him, power greater than myself, I started to think, you know, I'm not sure that's going to work for me. I hope they got something better than that because of my preconceived understanding of what I thought God was. I'm really glad that the 12-step fellowships are open to one's interpretation. I'm really glad that they're not hardcore about how you explicitly need to believe in God and the attributes of God and, you know, what type of religious practices you need to maintain. I'm really glad that you don't see that in the 12-step fellowships because I needed to be allowed to be sober and wrong about my concept of God until I could start to practice some of the spiritual principles that were going to expose me to God. I needed to be able to stay sober that long. And my experience was, remember that gallon of vodka I drank? Well, that didn't go too well. And for about 6 or 7 months, I was out drinking. And it was worse than it had ever been. And finally, there was an event, and there was a detox, and I stopped drinking. And I went back to AA. I went back to AA shaking like a leaf. I mean, it was a really, really bad experience for me the first couple of weeks because I hadn't slept and I was just ringing. But I wanted to survive this thing. I wanted to not feel this level of bad anymore. you know, so I did. I went back to AA and I started to go to meetings like a wild man. I was at least every night. I went to a meeting every night for my first 8 years, if you can imagine. Not 90 and 90. You know, that's ridiculous. I went to 12 meetings a week for a long time. I didn't have a better plan, and I was desperate. And I had that willingness that can sometimes be born of that desperation. So I'm going to AA like crazy. And I get myself a sponsor. I don't know what his concept of God was, but he definitely was a praying man. And he definitely did believe in God, and he slowly coaxed me along a little bit. I remember going over to his house one time, and something really bad had happened, and I was so emotionally upset I couldn't even talk. I was like, Phil, you know, knocking on his door. He goes, Chris, come on in. And you know, I was able to tell him what happened or whatever, and he basically, this was his advice to me, which I thought was, I can't tell you what I thought of his advice at this point in time because I had some real problems and I kind of thought he might not have heard me right or whatever. Because his advice was, Chris, here's what I want you to do. When you wake up in the morning, I want you to get on your knees and I want you to ask God for the strength and direction to get through the day. And before you get in bed at night, I want you to get on your knees and I want you to thank God for his strength and direction. That's all I want you to do. And I'm thinking, like, what is that going to do? What in the world is it? That's like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb, you know, compared to the problems that I have. You know, but he was the wise sponsor. He was the guy who was right most of the time. You know, if I thought it was going to go left and he said it was going to go right, he had like this series, a winning streak of being right. So I decided to do what he said. And what I did was I very slowly began a process of coming to believe in a power greater than myself that can help keep me separated from alcohol and help rebuild my life, can be the instrument of the rebuilding of my life. And I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time. I was just kind of following directions. So often that's what we need to do. That's why so many places, that's why so many sponsors, so many recovery processes ask you to do things that go contrary to your own will. Like, I don't want to do that. Well, we want you to do this because what happens is it contributes to your spiritual growth, whether you believe it's going to or not. The action translates into a spiritual experience, whether you want it to or not, whether you figured it out or not. These behaviors tend to do that. So, you know, here I am. I'm praying and I'm starting to pick up some of the books. They were handing out a lot of books back then. That was kind of the Oprah Winfrey type of AA that was happening in the 80s. right, Katie? And they had a lot of books out there, you know, a lot of bestsellers. There was The Road Less Traveled. There was Emmett Fox. There was, you know, a whole bunch of stuff was going on. And I started to read these things. Somehow, intuitively, I knew that I needed to grow spiritually to be able to survive this stuff. And I started to actually do some spiritual things. When I would be confronted with incidents at work or incidents with the family, more and more I was taking the high road instead of the selfish road. More and more I was trying to do the next right thing instead of the thing that will benefit Chris that second, you know, right now. So, you know, I started to change my behavior in small, slight ways. I was going to a lot of meetings. I started to sponsor people. I started to do things that were unselfish. My first sponsor was a big service guy. He was way into service, and he wanted me to be too. And he said, Chris, that treatment center that you went to a year ago, When you're a year sober, you're going to go back there and you're going to start taking meetings into them. And so a year sober, on the day I was back in this treatment center bringing the message in, he goes, "You're going to volunteer for this. You're going to volunteer for that. We're having a picnic for the home group. You're going to cook." And he had me doing all these things. These things were counter to the way I would have done things. If I went to a big picnic in a big park with a bunch of people, I'm not going to be the guy cooking. I'm going to be the guy eating. You know, that was just automatic for me. And he changed that by making me the guy that was cooking. So in many, many little ways, I was starting to change and I was starting to grow spiritually. Now, in step two, I love the chapter, We Agnostics, because it pretty much takes into account that we're going to have a lot of agnosticism. We are not going to believe that there is a divine providence that is going to shine down on us and recover us from alcoholism. We're not set up to believe that. Our prior experience has sometimes been really God-awful, and to think that just because we're going to change the way we think or change the way we're going to behave, we're going to get direct access to God. We're not going to believe that. And that's really what agnosticism is. It's not believing that there's a God. It's believing that the power of God is not going to necessarily be available to you. And that's really the way I felt. Luckily, a lot of the things that I was doing were contributing to my spiritual growth. And that contributed to a spiritual awakening. I believe that alcoholism or drug addiction is our problem. And spiritual living, broadening and deepening our spiritual life is the solution. I truly do. I don't think that there's a medication. I don't think that there's a therapy. I don't think that there's basically one practice that's going to be able to go up against alcoholism or drug addiction. It's just too aggressive a problem. I think that the only thing that we can do is to begin to participate in this recovery process. Sometimes we have to place ourselves in the spiritual climate for God to be able to do what God does. The Spirit, the power to do what the Spirit or power will do with us and help us to change. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and we'll be back here at 2:00. Thanks. Okay, we're back. Thanks everybody for coming back. Was talking a little bit about step two and, you know, what it kind of meant to me in the early days. You know, we're all going to have our own experience with God. We're all going to have our own experience with spiritual growth. That's the really cool thing about the 12-step methodology. It really allows us, you know, to experiment, to explore, and it also allows us to be imperfect. You know, I was just talking with somebody outside before I came in, and we were both talking about how imperfect we can be. You know, here we are, you know, people talking about, you know, the spiritual life and spiritual practices. and how surprising it can be sometimes where, you know, we fall short personally of these spiritual goals and principles. But I really don't think it's the mistakes that we're going to make that's going to interfere with our spiritual growth. I think it's how we apply the lessons that we learn. Some of the worst things that happened to me in recovery, some of the worst things that happened to me with personal relationships inside and outside of AA while I was getting sober and recovering, have been monumentally helpful to me in my perspective. You know, in the chapter We Agnostics, Bill basically kind of expects that we're certainly going to have a lot of disbelief. We're certainly not going to buy in right away to the fact that God is going to restore us to sanity and we're going to walk away perfect. He doesn't really expect that. He talks about cause and effect in that chapter. Now, spiritual living, spiritual results, that's cause and effect. Trying to do the next right thing, making an effort to do the next right thing, having the right thing happen to you, that's cause and effect. Being considerate of other people for once in our lives, you know, trying to be considerate of other people are considerate of us. It's cause and effect. And this isn't a new phenomenon. You know, religions and philosophical systems for many, many years have understood the importance of this. Karma, treat people as you would have them treat you. I mean, these lessons are as old as history itself. We just didn't seem to be believing them very much. So they ask you to take some things on faith prior to having this really strong belief in God. You have to take some things on faith. And the things that you take on faith are basically the spiritual exercises that allow you to develop an effective relationship with God. You know, I don't consider myself a religious person. I certainly have no issue at all with the church. I'll go on special occasions. I'll go when grandchildren are being confirmed. I'll go to weddings and funerals. I sponsor some ministers. You know, I have absolutely nothing against those particular institutions. But I see religion as a little bit separate from what we're talking about here. We're talking about here more about our behavior necessarily than how we line up with certain sects or denominations. And, you know, it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, many of us go back to our religions of choice, and that's good. Many of us don't become church members, and that's okay too. But what's not optional is our spiritual growth. We definitely need to begin to grow spiritually. And we have to put the time in. We have to put the work in. You know, alcoholism is just going to run rampant on us if we don't. I was in a meeting the other night, and it was one of these meetings. Most people in here have probably been to discussion meetings, whether it's AA, NA, CA, whatever. And you know, sometimes they can get way off track, and people can start to talk about their problems and the way they think and things that have happened and how they feel about them. And you know, I was in one of these meetings, and the topic was alcohol. You know, oh my God, it was. It's very unusual in an AA meeting to have the topic be alcohol. Now, I don't know why that is, but it's unusual. And what happened was in the beginning half of the meeting, people were talking about how they avoid it, how they stay away from it, how they've gotten it out of their house, how they feel uncomfortable when they go there. And then by the second half of the meeting, some people who have actually recovered from alcoholism start to share. And this one guy raises his hand, and you know, he's got about a year or whatever, but he's got a sponsor, he's going through the steps, he's doing the work. And he shares about how he likes to go to concerts. And he goes to these crazy concerts where, you know, there's just, you know, it's in the air. You know, you can smell the pot in the air and everybody's drinking. And he goes, there's a group of us that are sober. There's a small group of us that are sober. And, you know, we congregate with each other and it's nice to see each other. It's a little fellowship within this big musical environment. And he's sharing this. And I can see that some of the people in the meeting are like, he's playing on the tracks. He's playing on the tracks. I got a chance basically to share after that. And, you know, what I shared was my own personal experience that, yes, when I was early on, it was a good idea to stay away from the situations where people were drinking, the situations where people were doing drugs. But if you recover from alcoholism, it's not going to be how far away is this stuff from me? Is, you know, I'm not going to relapse just because I'm at a party where people are drinking. There's a bigger problem involved, and that problem is I need to be spiritually sound all the time. And if I am, then I truly am safe and protected from the alcohol and the drugs. And I share this, and I can see about half of the room got it. You know, half of the room understood what I was talking about because they had a recovery experience. The other half of the room have had a sobriety experience for a long time and don't get that. They don't understand that there's freedom. You know, in the 12-step process, I truly believe the 12-step process is about two things. I believe it's about power, and I believe it's about freedom. The power comes through aligning myself with these spiritual principles, doing the spiritual exercises, the steps, the principles, the next right thing. There's a lot of them out there. There's a lot of choices for us to make during the day, and we do the best we can with those choices. And, you know, if we do that, there's a power that works that you begin to experience working in and through you. And many of the early AA members called that power God. You know, you can have whatever relationship you want with it. In the 12-step fellowships, they're not going to tell you what kind of God you have to believe in. But they will tell you without that experience of God, you're going to die. You're not going to make it. That experience, that power has to work in and through you. And remember I talked to you about my first earliest conception of God being, you know, in the white robe with the long beard, you know, sitting up in heaven with a ledger, you know, oh, Schroeder did this. You know, that was my earlier conception. It's developed for me and it continues to develop. And, you know, what I say here today may be completely different tomorrow. And I am so fine with that. But today, I believe in the divine power because I have experienced it. That power has worked in and through me and helped to probably drove the changes in my life today. Certainly, the power will enable you to stay separated from drugs, alcohol, you know, whatever you're powerless over. That power will come in and enable you to stay separated from that. The mistake we sometimes make is claiming that power as our own. I think it's the most arrogant thing in the world to do, to say, I stay sober because I do this. I stay sober because I do that. I think it's much more accurate to say, because I'm able to participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition, I place myself in the sunlight of the Spirit, where that Spirit can work in and through me and keep me separated from God. So I can place myself in the sunlight, but I can never be the sun. If I start to believe that I can stay sober just by willing it or just by making a decision to stay sober, I've now set myself up for a big failure. But again, the wonderful thing about this program is we can develop whatever type of belief systems in God we really want, but we all need to be part of the experience of God to actually have that experience work in our lives. I don't know about anybody else in here, but I've had periods of time, you know, in my childhood, even in my drinking and drugging days, where I've felt close to the divine. Bill talks about it in his story. He says he walks into Winchester Cathedral and, you know, the pipe organs are playing and the choir, and he just felt that oneness of God. And then he left and he got drunk and it went away. You know, that's what it's like for us. I mean, I have felt that presence, that oneness. I think we are driven to feel that oneness. I think that's what drives our alcoholism and our drug addiction. To feel good. To feel right. To feel like we're at the right place at the right time with the right people doing the right things. You know, and that's that. Those feelings are so elusive to us prior to a recovery experience. I can tell you today, after many, many years working this program, many, many years sponsoring and being sponsored, many, many years making an effort to do the next right thing and sometimes really falling short, you know, I can tell you that I feel like this is exactly the place that I should be right now. And I feel that way most of the time. You know, most of the time. So that power is something that we want to work toward getting. Who would not want power? You know, and some of the crazy conceptions I had in the early days was if I get all spiritual, I'll end up being this wimpy guy and I won't have, you know, I won't have the same personality that I have, and I'll end up being one of those dull blades, you know, that nobody wants to talk. That is not what happens. What happens is when you get power, and that power will enable you to become, you know, things that you don't even have any clue to right now. You're gonna be able to become what I believe God wanted us to be all along, and that's, you know, human beings having a spiritual experience. And when we get to the end of the road, we're going to be unbelievably grateful for being on this planet, experiencing, you know, these experiences that we get. You know, we're here in Texas. I love Texas. We're driving. I'm in a hotel about 25 minutes out of here. And we're driving in and we're going over these hills and I'm looking at this beautiful expanse of territory and I'm thinking, you know, this is God's cathedral. You know, this is my cathedral, this nature. I just love it. And I love having an opportunity to be here. You know, satisfaction is an important part in our life. That has a lot to do with our quality of life. Are we satisfied, you know? Are we grateful for our experience? You want to have a quality of life. Those are some of the attributes of a quality of life that are important. You got to be enjoying what you're doing. The saddest thing I know about alcoholism and drug addiction is the amount of suicide that happens with alcoholics and drug addicts. You know, we just lost somebody else up in one of our groups up in New Jersey. You know, got to a point where, you know, existence was so intolerable for them that they decided to check out. And that's something that many of us do. We're somewhere between 50 and 60 times more likely to take our own life than non-alcoholics or non-drug addicts. You know, that's scary because we get to that place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So the antidote to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is a spiritual awakening, is to get to a point where you are eminently satisfied with the aspects of your life. You love the people that you're with. You enjoy every single day. Some days more than others, but you enjoy every single day having an experience here on this planet, you know, with your fellow man. the distance, the separation of the alcoholic is an absolute tragedy. You know, so I think about the 12 steps as an end. It even says this in the step book somewhere, an end to isolation. My last 5 years of drinking, I drank by myself. And there was a number of reasons for that. One of them was because I was growing increasingly violent, it was just safer for me not to leave the house when I drank. And the other is there wasn't a whole lot of people lining up to spend time with me, you know, when I was drinking. I'd buy a bottle of booze when I got out of work, and I'd be drunk in about an hour and a half, and I'd be blacked out in three, and I'd be passed out in four. And that just drinking for that oblivion, just trying to shut my head off, trying to check out. And that is about the saddest thing, you know, you're ever going to see. Step one, obsession of the mind, allergy of the body, lack of power, choice, and control, unmanageability, both external and internal. I cannot manage my life to get any kind of quality out of it. I am emotionally, spiritually, mentally, psychically just damaged up. And I am not having a real good time here. You know, that really is step one. Step two is believing at least a little bit on faith what some other people are talking about what the power can do. What can that power do? That power can transform us. That power can enable us to recover from alcoholism. Just believing that a little bit is enough to get started. And if you believe that, the next logical step is to make a decision to seek this spiritual life. That's what the rest of the steps are. They're to enable us to clear enough of the wreckage away so God can come in, do God's job. The power can come in and do the power's job and get us ready to be, you know, members of society, to get us ready to be able to be healers, to be mentors, to be part of the solution instead of the problem. You know, so we make a decision in step three to go through the rest of the steps. We make a decision in step three to start developing and deepening our relationship with this power, to seek this power. Because in this power is everything. It's everything we sought from drugs and alcohol, only more. It's better. It's more powerful. It's more consistent. And it doesn't blow your life up like drugs and alcohol do. So I'm going to make a decision in step three, and I'm going to seek this power. I'm going to align myself with this power. I'm going to do my work, my job, placing myself in the spiritual atmosphere, and I am going to hope that the power comes in and works in and through me to transform my life. There was someone that. The benchmark very, very kindly took in. This person was very special to me, and most of you are going to probably know who she is because she just left not long ago. Anyway, I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like before she came down here. Now this girl, this is a sweet, sweet girl, but she was as alcoholic as I've ever seen anybody. Now, alcoholism is not about how many cars you crash, how many fights you get in, how many bottles of booze you can drink, you know, how many people you can drink under the table. Alcoholism, the barometer, is power, choice, and control. And looking at this girl, she was at the absolute bottom of the thermometer. You know, one more degree and she would have been dead. And we were all working with her. We were all, taking her to meetings and sitting talking with her. She was in little work groups at night, you know, going through the steps. She had a number of really good sponsors. But there was a lack of total commitment to this thing. She would be inconsistent. In other words, after a relapse or something, she would start working, she'd go to meetings, she'd get a sponsor, she'd start working with people for a while, and 3 months would go by, 6 months would go by, and then she would become inconsistent with the behavior modificational requirements of this process, and she would drink. And when she would drink, she would be so bad within a couple of hours that she'd have to drink in her bed. And she would do things like get the postman to bring her booze, you know, because she couldn't leave the house. And we were really, really worried that she was going to die like the next time she drank, because she would go from being halfway healthy to incapacitated in need of the emergency room within a couple of days. And you know, we sent her down here. I called up Marcia and I said, Marcia, can you do me a favor? And she came down here. Now, she just came back to us about a month ago. And I've got to tell you, you can see the change. You can see it in her eyes. Her eyes are alive. She used to not really be able to look you directly in the eye for very long. And you can see that an initial stage in the recovery process has been achieved. And if she stays consistent with the meetings, if she stays consistent with working the steps with the sponsor or the spiritual advisor, and if she truly dedicates a good portion of her life to giving back and to working with others, and whatever type of service ethics she puts together, she's going to be okay. And she's going to make it, you know. This really, really is about life and death, the stuff that happens here. Alcoholism, the manifestation of ego in alcoholism, manifests like this. I'll tell you how it manifested with me in treatment. And if you relate to this, fine. If you don't, that's fine too. Remember, I signed myself into treatment because I was going to die from drinking. The moment I got to treatment, I started to see some inequities. And I remember going up to the nurse and talking to the nurse, how come so-and-so can use the phone and I can't? And, you know, the food is really bad. And you know, I'm wondering why you don't give us sugar or coffee, because they didn't give you sugar or coffee. And why can't you talk to the women? You know, why are we not allowed to speak with them? And I had all this stuff. Now, listen, I've just asked these people to save my life. And I'm starting to criticize. And I remember in some of the groups, somebody would be sharing. And it'd be about an hour group, and there'd be a little circle. There'd be about six or eight people in that circle. I don't know what they called it. It was just, you know, group, I guess they called it. And somebody would hog the time. And I would get annoyed at that. Oh, my God. I remember this one guy, Doug, would hog the time. He had nothing to say, but he said it anyway. Rah, 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 talk, 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 share, 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 share. And one of the things that he would share is, you know, oh my, you know, my wife's got a restraining order. He says, oh, I can't go back home. He was like, oh, I'm gonna, and he started to share about he wanted to jump in front of a bus. I'm going to jump in front of a bus. And he said, I'm going to jump in front of a bus. And I would be really, you know, I wasn't empathetic. I was like pissed he was taking my time. And I remember this one day, I went down to the nurse's office and I go, listen, can I use the phone? And she goes, well, what do you want to use the phone for? I go, I need to get some bus schedules. You know? This was my capacity of, you know, giving. And I remember there was a truck driver who would do the same thing. He'd just talk, talk, talk. Me, me, me. Talk about me, talk about me, talk about me. And I would just go crazy. And it's just, will you just shut up? Will you just drink, you know, and get the hell out of here? You know, I want to talk. You have this thing coming at you in early recovery, and it's called the manifestation of the ego, and it wants to kill you, you know, and that is it's so dangerous because it wants you to change your mind about committing yourself to this process. And it will do just about anything to change your mind. Because the ego doesn't want you compliant. The ego doesn't want you to participate in this recovery process. Because the ego is going to get minimized by doing all that. I think ultimately what the sages and the mystics and the religious masters want to teach us is the closer you can get to the absence of ego, the further along you are as spiritual people. You know, and it just so happens that our ego as alcoholics really, our ego, who said this? Our ego is not our amigo.
Charlie
says that. And that is absolutely so true. Our self-centered nature is really what the problem is. When the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the problem, it doesn't say our problem is drinking. It doesn't say our problem is drugs. It says our problem is an innate, core level selfishness. And many of us don't believe. I didn't believe I was selfish. I was the kind of guy who, yeah, I'd share some of my Coke with you, but not my bourbon. You know, I would be generous with the money, basically because I was very lonely, and the only place to the only way to get anybody to spend any time with me is to, like, you know, fund something. And if you were a somewhat friend of mine and you called me up and said you need to come over and bail me out of jail, I'd go bail you out of jail, but I'd expect, you know, certain loyalties after that, you know. And so I was under the illusion that I was not really selfish. So selfishness and self-centeredness, at its core, is about that separation, you know, from mankind, that separation from the divine. I mean, at core, that's really what it is. Believing that we are, we're islands, and, you know, believing that we're all, you know, we're on our own, you know. And that's just the way we think. I think it was Einstein, at least somebody said it was Einstein, who said this: mankind's greatest illusion is believing that there's more than one of us here. I mean, think about that. Think about that. When you look at life itself, you know, we're part of a species on a planet. You know, we're tribal, and we have to work together for our own survival. And there's many types of, you know, behaviors. We all have our place, you know, in this situation, in this human experience. We all have our place. And for somebody to believe that they're apart from all that really is kind of an insanity. And it's certainly part of the spiritual illness of alcoholism. You know, why do people get this wrong who try to help us? One of the things I do is I'm part of a group called C4 Recovery Solutions. I just got asked again to be a board member of the NCADD. I've done commitments in treatment centers since 1991 pretty consistently. I've been asked to do some things that really taught me a lot about addiction treatment and exposed me to a lot of different people working in and around addiction treatment. I've been able to network people around the country to other people to do studies and put business plans together for different types of things. One of the things that I was just helping somebody work on was a cell phone app, which is basically it's got a GPS function, okay? And you're in early recovery, you got your cell phone with the GPS. There's a program that's being developed that'll be able to show you how many meetings you've gone to, whether you've talked to your sponsor. I mean, it's like the compliance type of tool for, you know, so your counselors or your aftercare people or whatever are going to be able to see you heading for trouble before you do. And this is, you know, I've been involved in a lot of different things like this. And I need to tell you that most people get this thing wrong. Most people are still convinced that it's the alcohol or it's the drugs that are really your problem. Some of the ones that truly understand what is going on understand that it's the drugs and the alcohol that are symptoms of a greater problem, a spiritual problem, a problem that that manifests through our ego, through our selfishness. through our belief that we are separate from. And the ones that get that are all about the big book. They're all about the 12-step processes, and they recommend them as highly as you can possibly recommend them. There's also a lot of people out there who are professional addictionologists and who don't get it. I was having some fun. I don't do this anymore because it gets me aggravated, and I don't need to be aggravated. But I was doing some blogging on some LinkedIn groups. You know, LinkedIn has all these professional groups, addiction professionals, and, you know, treatment provider professionals, and, you know, all this stuff. And I'll throw my two cents in there every once in a while. And this one guy makes a comment to somebody who's new, who's looking for help. And here's what he says. He goes, "I don't recommend anybody to AA or NA anymore. My God, their statistics are horrible. You know, I recommend counseling to them." And I took exception to this. The statistics are horrible. And, you know, I kind of went back at him a little bit. And he goes, "Look, I don't send anybody to the 12-step fellowships anymore. Why would I with a 6% recovery rate?" He goes, I could give my patients a placebo and I could guarantee you better than 6%. And this is what he wrote me back. And, you know, I go, you know, I've got to respond to this guy because he's wrong. He's right a little bit, but he's also big wrong. He's more wrong than he's right. Does AA have a 6% recovery rate? If you get your statistics like the people who go after these studies do, they wait by the door. Now, a lot of times this will happen in New York or Chicago or LA, where there's a lot of recidivism. There's a lot of in and out through those doors. And if you stand at that door and you do a survey of everybody walking in, you'll find that probably over 50% of them have less than a year. A huge percentage of them are not going to be there in 6 months. That's just kind of the way the fellowship works. If you take your survey at the door. So this is what I basically said to him. I said this. I go, "Okay, you're a doctor, right?" "Yes." I go, "Let's say you come up with some type of an operation that helps in the recovery of cancer. Let's say you believe your operation is going to work every time. I mean, you truly believe that. Let's say that 95% of the people that come to your hospital to get that operation, all they do is they sit in the waiting room and they talk to other people with cancer and they share their feelings and their experiences and stuff back and forth, but only 5% of them go in and actually get the operation." I go, would you like people saying that your operation is only 5% effective? And he goes, "No, of course not." I go, "Well, you're doing that to the 12-step recovery process. Because we don't judge efficacy on who walks through the door. We judge efficacy on rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And if you haven't made amends, if you haven't done a fourth and a fifth step, if you're not praying and meditating, the discipline, I'm in this room, so I'm going to say the disciplines of 10 and 11, the disciplines of 10 and 11. If you're not disciplined with 10 and 11, and if you're not carrying the message to the still sick and suffering alcoholic or drug addict, then you haven't thoroughly followed the path. And you may not deserve to be in the 95% of the people who recover from this who do that. You know, it's probably higher. The percentages are probably higher. But I'll give that 5% because of, people who pick up the wrong prescription. You know, I'll say that there's probably a 5% error rate, you know, even if you do all the right stuff. But, you know, that's truly what I believe. I believe that for the longest time, people were thinking that working a program was going to meetings. Listen, going to meetings will not relieve you of that sense of separation. a lot of times it just made me feel more separate. You know, all I did was judge in some of those early meetings. I couldn't believe, oh no, he's going to raise his hand. Oh my God, he's going to share again. I know exactly what he's going to share. Oh, please don't call him. Oh, I called on him. Oh, here he goes. Oh my God. I hope he doesn't go on too long. Oh my God. You know, that was what I was thinking in the meetings in the early days. You know, today it's a different story. I'm still not real fond when that guy raised his hand, but I do have a tolerance. I do have a patience, and I don't suffer because of this guy sharing. I don't suffer anymore because of the way people behave and act around me. Suffering is optional. You know, that emotional suffering, that truly is optional if you consider that there's a path toward recovery. Now, what can you do? What can you do when you leave here? They're going to give you a good plan. They're going to give you a plan. Do not let your ego tell you that this plan is not really perfect for you because you're different. Don't. Okay, the plan is perfect. You're not. You know, the plan is perfect. And I know this place enough to know that it's going to consist of meetings. It's going to consist of step work, working closely with a sponsor. And it's going to consist of service work, sponsorship work. And that really is, that's really the keys to the kingdom there. You also need to understand consistency. It's not okay to throw everything you have into this and just kind of get tired and burn out and, you know, drift away from it. It's better to throw half of yourself into this and keep half of yourself in than it is to throw everything you got into it and then burn out and stop going altogether. Consistency is absolutely key. Finding somebody that will hold you accountable is important. I'm 22 years sober now, okay? And I've got a sponsor who I've given them spiritual consent to kick me in the ass when I need it. And when he hears something in my voice, when he hears ego raising its ugly head again in a bad way, he lets me know. He lets me know I am being a horse's ass. And he's allowed to do that. I love him enough to allow him to do it, and he loves me enough to do it and not worry about how it makes me feel. To have someone that is going to hold us accountable. Our ego is going to want to separate us because our ego is about that separation. It's going to want to separate us from anybody and everybody that's going to be eyeballing us. Don't let that happen. Stay connected to somebody that's going to hold you accountable. The step work has to become second nature to us. It has to become our default setting. I love step 10. Life is going to turn you upside down. It will. That's what life is about. Life, there are unexpected events that are going to happen out there. If you put yourself into the world, if you go back out there and you become a participating member in society, things are going to happen to you. People are going to get in your face. You're going to get into arguments. There's going to be bad things that are going to happen to you. There's going to be bad people that interact with you. You know, to stay on sound spiritual ground is what you need to do. None of us are going to do this perfectly, but we have to perfectly keep trying. I believe that you don't get A's, B's, and C's in this. I believe that it's really pass fail. If you do enough, you're going to recover. If you participate enough in the maintenance of your spiritual condition, you're going to recover. And recovery is very difficult to describe. It's difficult to describe recovery to someone who has never experienced it because it's not part of your mindset. One of the reasons I loved Mark Houston so much and Joe Hawk, his really good friend, so much is because they were able to put language around spiritual processes, experiences, and practices that made them make sense to me. There was a lot of people who talked, a lot of talk. There's a lot of wonderful spiritual speakers out there, but I never understood okay, you're talking about your experience. How did you get that? I love the way Mark and Joe explained the process of the steps. And I know one of the tape sets that you listen to here is the one that Mark did in Hunt, Texas. I think that's one of the top five spiritual workshops I've ever listened to in my life. And if you pay attention to that, one of the things that's going to be awesome is it's going to mean more and more to you as the years go by. You're going to get this much out of it. It's going to be a wonderful this much in your first year. In your 25th year, you're going to get this much out of it. And it's going to be that much wonderful stuff. It's truly timeless, and it's truly material that will hit you where you are. And no matter where you are in the recovery process, it's going to be meaningful to you. So I believe a lot in listening to some of the enlightened masters of recovery that have preceded us and that paved the way for our understanding of the problem and our understanding of the solution. There can be a lot that can be gained by that. I spent many, many, many years instead of listening to music in the car, listening to recovery speakers, and that helped me greatly. The choices that you have, the choices that you're going to make are going to be incredibly meaningful. You know, starting now with your experience at Benchmark, they're going to mean everything to you in the future. If you make the right decisions, if you start to develop the disciplines, if you start to develop the practices that are going to lead to recovery, what's going to happen is there's going to be a tipping point in your life where your life is going like this, and then all of a sudden something happens and it starts to go like this. And that can be your experience here. The great thing about recovery is it's accumulative. The bad thing about addiction is it's progressive and accumulative. You know, it gets worse over any given period of time. The thing about recovery is it gets better over any given period of time. And you're gonna wanna make the most of your experience here. You truly are. If I didn't have a job and I was on unemployment, and that's not my lot in life, I became unbelievably employable, you know, in recovery, which that's just what will happen to you probably. But if I was unemployed, you know, I would call up Marcia and say I need a retreat. I'm coming down for a couple of months because this is the genesis for so much this type of experience. You know, getting your first exposure to some of the steps, getting getting your feet wet a little bit with the spiritual life is an important time, and I can't tell you, you know, this place will become more and more meaningful if you recover. This place will become more and more meaningful to you as you grow. Some of the promises that you can expect are incredible. These promises have all come true for me. They've all come true for the guys that I've worked with and have been consistent with the recovery process. And that's that God, so here are some of them. God will give you more than you could have possibly designed yourself for your life. In other words, picture the best possible life you could ever have, and God's going to give you something that's more meaningful than that. The most important years of your life are ahead. Having the alcohol or the drug problem removed, that's a great promise, and that is a promise. The problem of the symptom of alcohol and the symptom of drug addiction will be removed. And that will enable you to go back out in the world without putting a gun to your head every couple of days with the booze and the alcohol. Finding a host of friends I had some decent friends in high school. Not so many after college because my alcoholism got really brutal, and my life got decadent. And you know, toward the end, there were people who didn't even really have names that were hanging around me. They were, you know, Green Man and Weezer. They were my buddies. You know, but after I got I've got some incredible friends that. One of the problems in my life is I don't have enough time in the day. I actually have to sleep because I'm always feeling like I should reach out to this person, or I should spend time, or we should have dinner with this person, or you know, love to you know, to go to a meeting with this person. And there's just not enough time in the day. I have too many friends, you know, and they're the type of friends that you can count on. I mean, you can count on them. If you were in trouble, these are the type of people who absolutely would be there. I'm not just talking about helping you move, you know. I'm talking about, you know, serious things in your life. They will absolutely be there. You'll be able to progress in whatever direction or trajectory you choose, because you're not going to be shooting yourself in the foot anymore. I was an electrician for 10 years, and all 10 of those years I was a bad electrician. And the reason was is because I found it inconvenient to learn, and I found it inconvenient to be dependable and reliable and consistent. And so I was basically a helper for like 10 years. I mean, they considered me an electrical mechanic. But if you asked me to troubleshoot, you know, an elevator control circuit or something, I never learned those things. I could do the basics, and that's all I really cared about. I didn't have the stamina. I didn't have the enthusiasm to pay attention that much at work. Well, part of the recovery process is the power works in and through you. And all of a sudden, you're able to actually pay attention. You're able to actually participate. And that self-centered fear that keeps you from trying new things or learning new things or involving yourself in certain things is gone. So you learn new things. You involve yourself in new things. And what happened basically with me was, you know, I got to the point where today I'm the site lead for a pharmaceutical plant. And if you can imagine, going from a bad electrician to somebody who's in charge of all the mechanical, I'm in charge of all the soft services, I'm in charge of the contracting, I'm in charge of the HR stuff for all my people, you know, I'm a hiring manager, and you know, a union negotiator because I got union people that work for me. Human resource stuff, HS&E. I'm on all these committees, and you know, I'm doing live meetings like five times a day. You know, contributing to different accounts and central team. That's insane. If you knew what I was like prior to this, I wanted to go to work. Wire a light, get the hell out of there, go home and start drinking. Leave me alone. Don't call me on the phone. Don't ask me to work overtime. I am not interested. You know, because I just wanted out. I wanted to exit. And today, you know, having that power available, that power that pulls enough of my ego out to be able to participate in some of these things has enabled me to become pretty successful with my life. You know, I just got a huge promotion last month. It's like the biggest promotion the company's given in years. You know, and out of 19 accounts, I made more money than any other account, and my customer satisfaction was the highest of any account. Those are two things that are mutually exclusive. And again, just like a recovery experience, I can't take credit for that. Because me, on my own, I'm wiring one of your lights wrong and getting the hell out of there. That's me on my own. Being able to participate in the spiritual process and get to a point where you know, where I can become effective, where I can be more of a productive member, and not worry about what it's going to mean for me. You know, I'm more worried about the team or the account or the company than I am for me. Believe it or not, being at a place like that has offered me all kinds of opportunities. You know, who would have thought that when you wanted everything for yourself, you got nothing? And when you wanted to give back, you got everything. Who would have thought that? That doesn't make any sense, but it makes sense in the spiritual world. Who would have thought that I would finally find real quality recovery when I started to give it away to other people instead of just doing all the work for me? Who would have thought that by giving it away, I got more of it than I could imagine? That doesn't make sense. Except in the spiritual world, it makes sense. So, you know, if some of this stuff is confusing, if you don't understand why they're asking you to do something here, or you don't understand why, you know, why is this, why is that? Knowing why is the booby prize, okay? It truly is. Participating in it in a productive way is the gold ring. And so many of us, because of our attitudes and our outlooks, short-circuit this thing before it gets started. And we end up being part of those statistics that guy was talking about, the 95% of the people that don't make it. I don't want to be part of the 95% of the people that don't make it. Drinking to me is too ugly. It's too decadent. That relief that I was drinking for, that escape, doesn't exist anymore in alcohol for me. It doesn't exist, or else I wouldn't have sought sobriety. So, you know, my only, you know, really the only direction that I can give to anybody in here is, you know, you're going to hear it every meeting you go to. Be teachable. Become teachable. The Buddha used to talk about beginner's mind. And when you look at some of the Zen practitioners and Zen teachers, they're wonderful. Joe Hawk used to play these Zen games on me all the time. He would give me an exercise, and I'd get to the end of the exercise, and I'd go, Joe, I got it now. Wow, I can't believe you gave me that exercise. That's wonderful. This is what I understand now. And he'd go, wrong. He was just wonderful at that. What he was doing, you know, and you only know this in hindsight, is, listen, when you know, there's nowhere else to go. When you're right about something, why would you entertain any more opinions? So it's really, really important to have this open mind so that you can become teachable. Because if you have to grow in understanding and effectiveness, and you have to perfect and enlarge your spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice from others or die an alcoholic death, it's important to be open-minded so that you can grow. Because if you get to the end of a question with a flat out answer, then the exercise is over. And you know, I learned that from Mark's great friend Joe. He would not let me come to a full conclusion, because the conclusion is the booby prize. It's the seeking and it's the growing that's the brass ring. You know, so listen, you're all in this. You're going to be here a certain amount of time. Whatever that amount of time is, you probably think it's too long, if you're anything like me. Take advantage of it. This is a blessing. I know the people, and I know what they do here. This can be the beginning of an absolutely unbelievable experience for you if you let it. If you can get yourself out of the way just enough to let this stuff in and let this stuff start to do its work. Because the power that we need to seek is amazing. And the power can transform us in ways that are unimaginable to us currently, right here today. Transform us into things that are just unimaginable. I'm real, real happy to be down here. You know, I was over at a facilities conference 20 minutes away. I call up Marcia and I said I'd love to come out. And I know that everybody's everybody's schedule was changed so that I could come here today. I want to thank you all for that, and it's just a pleasure to be here. Thanks.